Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 82, section 3. We're ready to start the fourth paragraph there in section 3, which is at the bottom of old single column, page 915. Okay, so as we talked, introduced last week, we've launched the block of papers on marriage and family. We got through some of the very basic elements. If you glance back here in the beginning of this paper, it's talking about the evolution of the institution of marriage. It obviously begins, you can see in section one, with just the basic fact of mating. Is the obvious biologic predicate for the social institution of marriage. And they started talking about the formation of moray systems. And as you can see in section two, it obviously, in very, very primitive times, all the more so, brings out the taboos. Those are always the dominant element of the moray system amongst primitive people, the thou shalt nots of the moray system. But then we got started in section three, where they're talking a little more just generally about the morays. It's invariably, even if it isn't literally a thou shalt not, it's bound to be, at least we would say restrictive. When you're talking about primitive mores, and that should be very obvious when you're talking about early mores that are trying to regulate the sex urge. It's obviously basically all going to be about various restrictions and means to find a way to stabilize society, even if it is a very primitive society, to deal with that animal urge so you don't have a complete, free-for-all chaos. Okay, so we... as I said, we did the first three paragraphs. We're ready to start that fourth paragraph. I don't think I need to bring up anything specifically in those three. We can kind of just jump right back in and take it from where we left off. So let's see what they've got for us next here.
In primitive times, marriage was the price of social standing. The possession of a wife was a badge of distinction. The savage looked upon his wedding day as marking his entrance upon responsibility and manhood. In one age, marriage has been looked upon as a social duty, in another as a religious obligation, and in still another as a political requirement to provide citizens for the state.
Okay, so starting with that basic element, and when you see that first point, that it's about social standing, a badge of distinction. Let's just remind ourselves right up front, if you're feeling a little tinge with that relative to current sensibilities, the only way to get to the truth that's flowing through passages about very ancient mores, which are very different than the mores we have today, is to not judge them relative to their times. You're seeking how these statements about historical facts point to a perfectingness. You want to see how there's at least a potential there that you can recognize, if not a literal beginning, dynamic, becoming. A perfectingness. Because you're trying to strike step with the truths of eternity that are flowing through a description of past facts. If you approach those past facts in a very resistive, negative way, you are using your will to block the path to truth internally in your mind. That's the big challenge. It doesn't matter how primitive something is, all of reality is predicated on eternity. You're trying to understand how it is predicated on eternity, how there can be the truths of eternity there despite the primitiveness of the facts of time. So you obviously can't get all emotionally, and self-righteously caught up in the difference between those facts and the way we think about things now. Because if you can't handle that little sentence, it's going to be all the more difficult as we continue through this section, okay? They get more challenging than Badge of Distinction. Notice, one little key element. Okay, they purposely said the savage. Okay, so, but even in that context, you take the most primitive human possible, a savage, and look at the positive thing that's happening. He looked upon his wedding day as marking the entrance upon responsibility. So again, how many times have you heard me point out in various contexts that part of the emergency today is the lack of humans' recognition of personal responsibility in the exercise of self-control? And this should sober you. Well, even this primitive savage was challenging himself soberly to the responsibilities he had now. It doesn't matter if in some big picture the responsibilities he was facing are arbitrary and simplistic and primitive or whatever. That's irrelevant. He was trying to get a hold of himself, control himself. We all know that if you let things just go naturally, it's much more likely that a young male will go rogue than a young female. So the sense of responsibility has to be all the more acute, imposed upon the mores system in a very, very sober fashion. So they know it's an awesome responsibility, and if they don't meet it, they will be completely ostracized. And then that whole bit about what kind of ostracized might that be? Well, it might be just a social duty. But remember, to primitive people, what the word duty meant was that's what you had to do in order to keep the spirits at bay, or at least in a neutral state about you. Okay, so, that ghost fear thing, that was a sobering thing, okay? So even duty had a lot of weight to it, just mere social duty. But then you can even bring in, like they say, religious obligation. And the juxtaposition there, notice this, it's the same root of those two words, right? To bind in Latin. Right? Religion is bind back and obligate, you're binding to what you're facing. It brings in that that even more intimate relationship than just the social duty. You're bound by some higher power, if you will, or higher force, to this state. And, you know, and then just the practical thing, political requirement to provide citizens for the state, that's not just some primitive state, right? That's citizens for the state. We've got a big problem in Western nation states, that no one thinks they have a responsibility or even a requirement to provide citizens for the ongoingness of that state. They don't take the state seriously. And so there's a lot there that just on the surface that you can reflect on. But certainly the most immediately poignant is if we're losing all sense of responsibility, that's signs of a pre-primitive willed state, where you're not even doing what was sort of immediate and not almost automatic in the most primitive, barely human creature. Okay. What else do they tell us here?
Many early tribes required feats of stealing as a qualification for marriage. Later people substituted for such raiding forays athletic contests and competitive games. The winners in these contests were awarded the first prize, choice of the season's brides. Among the headhunters, a youth might not marry until he possessed at least one head, although such skulls were sometimes purchasable. As the buying of wives declined, they were won by riddle contests, a practice that still survives among many groups of the black man.
Yeah, so the obvious thing there is how the evolutionary process will use whatever is in play to hone the character of the humans involved. They face challenges. They rise to the challenge, all of this is in the context, like we mentioned last week, of how survival of the fittest comes into play when you're talking about social evolution. It's not just biologic evolution, and the differences that you start to have humans. Originality coming into it. It's not something that sort of just naturally comes about, but we bring it into play with originality. You notice that they used the word choice in there. Choice of the season's brides. In a very primitive context, you probably don't want to be thinking, oh, in a very conscious way, this primitive human is reflecting on eternity and trying to bring eternity, rather than mere time with a decision into play. That's happening super consciously, if they're using the word choice. But like I said, you'll see this in other places as we go forward. That fact that as a person, you can be original. You can be genuinely creative. So no matter how primitive, they're using that word, just like we'll use the word religion, even if it's a very primitive phenomenon in terms of what people have consciously, but it's a shadow that's cast down from a superconscious reality that is genuine religion. It doesn't have to be full conscious. Remember, they even point out, there is a fact of unconscious choices after all. Okay, so, if they use the word choice, they are wanting you to reflect that there is some beginning human element. It's not mere fancy animal. And then you can ask yourself, well, what specifically, is it that they're wanting me to consider is coming into play here?
Even today, a choice of a mate to live with your entire rest of your life is not a small...
Seems like a choice relative to eternity, you're saying?
It seems like it when you're faced with making it.
Yes.
It seems like a long time.
Right. Yeah. See, it's definitely an eternalizing, you know, like it was saying there, wedding day marking the entrance upon responsibility and manhood, right? That this was, you know, there was the frivolousness of time before that, and now there's the responsibilities of eternity, you know, that he's face to face with. I mean, yeah, it's, you know, to the degree to which they're at least eternalizing their thoughts, they're going beyond the moment, right? Consciously, they're bringing eternity into play superconsciously. Right? If eternity wasn't in play superconsciously, you would never have a motivation to expand your temporal perspective in time. Right? That's the motivation for that. That trying to, let's step back and, you know, think about this in a longer time context. I mean, that's that influence of your connection to eternity that you were given by grace, casting a shadow down into your temporal mind. Okay, so and just in the same way that we substitute athletic contests for direct war, you know, you can see how more primitive things. Contests play a big role in the evolutionary process as a means of not being so crude and direct in our approach. And that contests don't go away. Local universes have contests. You know, the angels in one local universe have a contest with the angels in the other local universe, you know. This sort of challenging ourselves is part of your whole ascension scheme and beyond. Okay.
We had some kind of entry qualification for the 100. $400.
Yeah, we don't know exactly how those decisions were made.
It's a riddle.
Riddle me this, and then you get the choice of brides. But the fun thing is, you'll see here in the next paragraph. Now that they have that this little more sophisticated system in play, it allows for humans to work with a little bit. You know, we're funny. We desire certain ends, but we're very respectful of traditions and stuff. And so we play games. Pardon the pun here in this context. We play games with ourselves, where you know we pretend that we're sort of maintaining the sacredness of the old way, but we find a scheme where we can move things forward, but not totally disrespect the traditions of the past. And so we, you know, that's a very common thing that we these clever species of self-deception that we play upon ourselves in order to slowly advance the moray system. Okay.
With advancing civilization, certain tribes put the severe marriage tests of male endurance in the hands of the women. They thus were able to favor the men of their choice. These marriage tests embraced skill in hunting, fighting, and ability to provide for a family. The groom was long required to enter the bride's family for at least 1 year, there to live and labor and prove that he was worthy of the wife he sought.
All right, so you can think about a young couple. They know each other. She knows what his natural abilities or, you know, or honed skills are. And coincidentally, that's the test, you know, that he excels in, and she gets to pick him then. I see. So it allows for some flexibility with this, right?
Or trip up the guy who she doesn't want.
Right. However she's playing the game. Now, when you read that last one about at least 1 year, That should remind anyone who's familiar with the Old Testament, of course, a very famous story of Jacob. Does anyone remember how many years he had to put in to satisfy his future father-in-law?
14?
Well, it's seven.
Seven.
Right, but then, you know, remember he gets fooled. He's looking for Rachel. He ends up with Leah, and he still wants Rachel. So he works another 7 years, so he ends up 14 for both of them. So sometimes, and as I recall the way that story goes, 7 years was nothing because his love for her was so great or whatever, you know. That's a classic story of that. That tradition
sure wised him up.
coming all the way up into Old Testament times and being played.
14 years, he switches back to Leah.
Well, we all know there was lots of kids from both. Let's see, anything else there? Notice how they're always very precise. You know, don't generalize a lot of these things that they're saying. They try to throw in certain tribes put, you know, things. I mean, there's a lot of variability, so don't think of a lot of these vignettes in some sort of a universal fashion. As they mentioned a couple times, I mean, there's as many mores about this as there are tribes, you know, basically. So it's a very, very complicated history. Okay.
The qualifications of a wife were the ability to perform hard work and to bear children. She was required to execute a certain piece of agricultural work within a given time. And if she had borne a child before marriage, she was all the more valuable. Her fertility was thus assured.
All right, so in the very earliest stages, no notions of virgins and all that sort of stuff had come into play. And I'll go into this a little bit more as we go forward. I mean, this is stressing what we were pointing out up front. It's not just in ancient times the way the word marriage was very much tied to a couple coming together for the purpose of procreating. I remember how we pointed out the revelators are trying to point out that that's a that's an appropriate precision for that word, and as society has gotten more complex and there's other kinds of unions that need to have social sanction, you need to coin other words. You need to at least have other phrases or something so that you can keep a precision. There's certain things, you know, in the laws or the mores that need to be there precisely only relative to the issue of a man and a woman procreating. And other issues, you know, they won't be handled properly if you blur everything all together.
In a way, this insistence on using the term marriage for all of these different relationships is kind of an indication of lack of imagination.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of things. It's a lack of imagination, like the revelators point out with language. You know, we've gotten very lazy with language. But it's also, the grass is always greener on the other side sort of a mentality. And it's like, you know, you lift up the concept of marriage. It's like, oh, I want to have that social standing too. You know, so I want to have something that's called that. And I mean, it gets silly like this where we, you know, we desire... Yeah, the incessant clamoring of inescapable self for recognition and honor sort of a thing. Anything else is some sort of a lower position, you know, so you demand the word marriage. We have to, you know, not be so immature about these sorts of things like that. But you see it right there. Besides the, this fitting into the evolution from hunter to herder to farmer, like we talked about way back when, and so when you've got the beginnings of farmer with the women handling the vegetable part of the diet and the men handling the meat, you know, and is that evolution from you know, from hunter and herder to farmer goes forward. So you're, they're reminding of the role of the relationship between men and women in that process. You know, and having to get over the concept, you know, of a man not wanting to be a farmer because that's woman's work, quote unquote. But the other key thing, and to bear children, like, you know, like I was just pointing out. I mean, that is what, and you'll see they stress that all the more as we go forward. That's the only thing to ancient people that marriage referred to. If there wasn't children, there wasn't marriage, period. Right? Let's see. And then, and then like I was saying, kind of back to the final statement, you know, we'll see how, as we go forward, how this, you know, there was a very complicated process of bringing in ever more, a lot of times, arbitrary notions of, you know, sex before marriage, sex outside of marriage, virginity, celibacy, chastity, you know, all these various things, you know, get played in as we go forward here. But it's obviously, remember, everything is starting with the horde, you know, where there's no families and there's no mores about mating and marriages or anything. It's all just, you know, animal sort of natural state. And so obviously there wouldn't be, you know, this is where it would start, you know, if all you're interested in is the fertility issue, you know, she's had a child before marriage, and, you know, it's just proof of what you're looking for. Is she fertile or not? Okay.
The fact that ancient peoples regarded it as a disgrace or even a sin not to be married explains the origin of child marriages. Since one must be married, the earlier the better. It was also a general belief that unmarried persons could not enter spirit land, and this was a further incentive to child marriages, even at birth and sometimes before birth, contingent upon sex. The ancients believed that even the dead must be married. The original matchmakers were employed to negotiate marriages for deceased individuals. One parent would arrange for these intermediaries to effect the marriage of a dead son with a dead daughter of another family.
So just that little, there's all these fun side notes of how things like matchmakers got started. But again, notice, even though you're going, well, it seems like we're bringing in marriages without sex and procreation, or even, you know, getting kids married before they're born and stuff. But, you know, you notice they threw it. I mean, it's in a temporary state. It doesn't become a full-on official marriage, right, until there's actual procreation happening, contingent upon sex, you see, they're thrown in. And they'll bring that out a little bit more as we go forward. You know, this just shows, like I was saying, you start with a very simple concept, but our gears are always churning, and we dream up all sorts of notions about spirit, ghost land, and spirit land, and whatnot, and then we got to come up with, you know, modifications of our simple concepts that still have the same basic idea, but all kinds of asterisks and footnotes. Now to the process. Let's see. Anything else?
Must be logical.
You know, I mean, an obvious parallel to this sort of mentality is, you know, the whole still ongoing argument about baptism. You know, whether or not you baptize as a child or as an adult, because if they're not baptized as a, you know, as a child, what if they die? Then they don't make it to heaven. You know, same thing here. See, they don't make it to spirit land if they're not married. Right. We have, you know, we have other variations on that same ghost land primitive concept. Anything else? Can we keep going? All right.
Among later peoples, puberty was the common age of marriage. But this has advanced in direct proportion to the progress of civilization. Early in social evolution, peculiar and celibate orders of both men and women arose. They were started and maintained by individuals more or less lacking normal sex urge.
Okay, so just what you might suspect, where celibate orders would, why those would originate. When they say peculiar there, don't think strange. Think distinctive. In some way, they wear different dress, like nuns and monks do, or, in some way they're distinct from others. You have these parallel subcultures that are developed, and they might be isolated in where they, or separated where they live, but at least there's a different adornment or something, right? I mean, that's what they mean by peculiar, distinctive in some way or another. Okay, now this whole issue of, I think everyone appreciates that it started out the way it would obviously tend to start out with, as soon as children reach puberty, this whole marriage institution concept, whatever it might be in that society, is the gears are going to start turning on that one way or another. And I think everyone knows that there's been a lot of evolution in this. Just to give you a little perspective, if you aren't familiar, how recent some of this evolution is. You have two issues in play. One is at what age will society allow you to get married? But a more fundamental thing, it starts out with mating. Before you think about the institution of marriage, just what's the age of consent in a society? And if you aren't familiar with that history, it's actually pretty amazing how recent it's gotten to the state it is. Like in the United States, if you think about the last 20 years of the 19th century, the age of consent everywhere in the United States was between 10 and 12. With the exception of Delaware, where even as late as 1895, it was 7. The age of consent in Delaware was 7, as recently as 1895. But remember where at what time you're in there. Right? You had the dawning of the Fifth Adjutant and the Collective in the middle of the 19th century. You have the beginning of all those social reformation movements of various sorts. And so not surprisingly, you would expect somewhere between the middle of the 19th century and the middle of the 20th century for there to be a significant evolution in the general sensibilities about the age of consent. So that, when you go from the last two decades of the 19th century, by the end of the first two decades of the 20th century, you basically had everything in the United States where the age of consent was 16 to 18, depending on the state. So, that quickly, it went from, basically a very, very sort of ancient sort of a mode, that is really tied to just as soon as the kids are in puberty stage, or even setting it kind of to when the youngest, when the earliest kids get to puberty. So it goes from that sort of a mentality to something that is much less tied to the mere biology of the phenomenon, and becomes much more of a construct that's originated by us reflectively considering issues of the greater good, all the different modalities of society. So, remember how different this would have evolved if we hadn't had the default. Adam and Eve, you know, almost 40,000 years ago, were beginning to set an example where, you know, you couldn't get married until 20. Right? I mean, all the kids in the first garden, they could be betrothed as early as 18, and then they had 2 years of premarital disillusionment classes, right? And then by 20, they were allowed to actually get married and begin a family. And you know, so we didn't have that modeling a much less biologically tied moray system. And so it took us a long time through the evolutionary process to kind of begin to recognize ourselves what Adam and Eve would have been teaching us about what works best for a developing society.
Do you think the age of puberty for the children of Adam and Eve were the same as the evolutionary stock, or do you think it was maybe later?
We talked about that a bit. You know, it's a little bit, you know, difficult to speculate, but the fact that the way they talk about the kids maturing, it seems like it's pretty similar. Or think about the way they talk about maturing children in the probationary nursery. It's like, oh, that sounds very familiar. Yeah. So I think, you know, once you don't have an extremely primitive people biologically, it's, you know, it's roughly this sort of timing that we appreciate. But there is going to be some sort of a stretching it out with the biologic uplift. There's no doubt. I mean, it's a little bit hard to say how much. They point out that the Andonite children developed much more slowly in a number of ways mentally than an Andite child. Okay, you do have a few general things that you know that there is some accelerating influences here in some ways, but then when it comes to issues of maturation of a higher concept of male-female relationship, that might not be as accelerated. That might be stretched out. I mean, it's a little bit, you see, you can argue it both ways. So it's a little difficult to say. But anyway, and just another thing to, you know, remember about the difficulty. You know, this is an important thing to keep in mind on this world. I mean, not only how recently our mores have radically changed about this, you know, I mean, it's just utterly shocking to our sensibilities now to think of not that long ago the age of consent was 7. I mean, that's just mind-boggling, to us now. But remember, I mean, it's not like everyone on the planet has gone, you know, to 16, 17, or 18 or something like that. I mean, probably one of the starkest examples is right in our backyard. Everywhere in Mexico is from 12 to 15, and a lot of it is 12. All right? So, you know, you're 12 is the age of consent, and you take one step across the northern border, and it's 18.
India is the same way,
right?
It's like a young age.
I won't say too many things because they're going to mention that in the next paragraph, or a couple paragraphs here. But just to keep in mind, you know that, a lot of places around the world have. It's even been more recently that they've taken the step to somewhere in the 16, 17, 18 ballpark. But there are still places that, you know, where it's still basically biased to puberty. I mean, I think there's even one little region in Mexico where it literally isn't tied to an age, but to puberty. Okay? So, but just to think about that, vast, tracts of Mexico, it's 12. And literally, you take one step across an arbitrary line in the sand, and it's 18. It's 18, all those states along the southwestern border there. So, that produces a lot of tension. We let all those people from Central Mexico and Central and South America, that have that long, they're still in that older mores system. That produces a huge problem in our society. We all know about teen pregnancies and all these various things. We can't just pretend that people can turn these mores systems on a dime. Including people that, their family has been in this country for many, many, many generations. They're a very old person. They grew up in a time when we didn't think like we do now. And it just becomes very difficult when the mores change so rapidly, and radically within the span of one person's lifespan. I mean, he goes from being sort of ingrained in an old mores system, kind of cemented by age 8, and then by the time he's 60, it's completely different, and he's judged in that new mores system and demonized if he even remotely thinks in the old mores system. And we have to be, this is a very difficult thing. We need to be more considerate of how diverse we are in the evolutionary process about the mating mores.
And it seems that in our country, our advanced country, that people are, even though the age of consent may be 18, people aren't consenting until they're 28. Mm-hmm. They're waiting longer and longer and longer to actually have a family or do that. And that's sort of maybe, as you're talking about how the mores evolve, and I don't know whether that's going too much in the wrong direction, because if you get really old, it's really hard to have a relationship with your kids, so to speak, that way.
Yeah, right, there's all kinds of, not to mention, there's a lot of reasons why kind of getting married and getting going with a family is not happening as automatically and at a young age as it used to. And you could say, we need to sort some of these things out. We're going through a lot of transitions. Yes, but that opens up the door for kind of family slipping through our fingers. And then you're back to the horde. And you can even start to have governmental, institutionalized modes that bias away from marriage and family. See, and again, you're driving the civilization out of your civilization. Everything in civilization is predicated on the family. And if families aren't sort of the prime focus of the government of a state, that statehood's not going to remain. I mean, it's going to start going backward to tribe, and you're going to end up in just a horde of fancy apes again. There's a lot of parallel things to what they bring in here as well.
I read a recent little article about marriage and young people today, and that was the gist of it was that young people today were waiting longer to get married, but they were actually staying married at a greater rate than their parents, who were younger than me.
Right, so that, and John was kind of bringing up a thought like that between the lines of what he was saying. See, there may be some positive things. By delaying, you can see we're about to read about how the primitives dealt with this. I mean, you delay a bit, there's some maturation, maybe things, will go better. We all know how difficult it is when two 18-year-olds get married. But at the same time, you wait too long, to really have the maturity. I mean, we don't even get to the age of wisdom until 40. We all can't wait until 40 to start families, okay? there's some of this, it's like you need to just go for it and work it out as you go. But we have to come up with some balance between encouraging maturity and just getting on with it. You know, we can't so encourage, well, let me wait until we're done with this. Well, we should be done with that too before we, and then, eventually you never get around to it. And guess what? There are no citizens and the nation collapses. Yeah, I mean, there's, you can't carry this too far or you just depopulate yourself.
Well, there's not a lot of family education.
Yeah.
There's people that's, it's gotten to be very natural.
Yeah, see, it's falling back into natural modes. You know, we're just reading about how early on they started doing unnatural things, and to not do even the rudimentary unnatural things is basically pre-primitive. It's so primitive anyway.
But most people, unfortunately, think it's the exact opposite of what you said.
Right, exactly. And
it's God's way.
Yeah. Right, and but talking about educating about families, how about just the one simple fact that every child that leaves our education system knows that the entire civilization, all the institutions of the civilization, are predicated on the family. They may not understand any of the details or whatnot, but they all should at least leave knowing that. And if they can't really know it, well, then they need to just believe it, okay? But it's got to be there. We have to be very focused on that. And government, that has to be one of their primary focuses, is to see to the integrity of families, or the whole thing is just going to collapse. Yeah, we'll get into the family part, as we go further along in these three papers. But, meanwhile, back to marriage. So the whole bit about... the age of consent and the age of marriage, we're just beginning to kind of get through evolution what Revelation failed to accomplish with Adam and Eve oh so long ago.
Many tribes allowed members of the ruling group to have sex relations with the bride just before she was to be given to her husband. Each of these men would give the girl a present. And this was the origin of the custom of giving wedding presents. Among some groups, it was expected that a young woman would earn her dowry, which consisted of the presents received in reward for her sex service in the bride's exhibition hall.
Okay, now we've gotten to something that's more controversial than badge of distinction, haven't we? yes, this paragraph is a classic.
Bring some animal heads with you.
So, but see, you go, how on earth could they ever think this? I mean, is this just one of those species of self-deception, we know is in play at times, like with temple prostitution and some things like that, finding clever ways to, to have a sex outlet, that's sanctioned by society. No, you need to think a little bit more deeply. This isn't just scheming in the name of gratifying your sex urge. One of the key things in the evolutionary process, no matter how far you advance, it's long believed that the ancient concepts are more powerful. Okay? See, and you can see what you have in play here. You have that horde mentality still coming along, still finding some place within the newer mores system. You have families, marriage, and all this sort of stuff, but you can't totally throw out the way the horde functioned and how that was exalted and believed, like John was saying, that's a very, very advanced idea, right? It wasn't that confusion where you think it's a new idea, but it's actually an old idea. They were remembering the old idea and still honoring it and giving it a place, because there's a lot of power in the old ways. You know, like I always joke, you know, if you want to really get God to do something for you, don't you know, request it in English, request it in Latin, right? Because then he can't resist you, right? Because Latin's an older language and it's more powerful. We still play that game with the Greek gods. You know, you take the Greek pantheon, you go back to, you know, the previous generation, they're bigger and more powerful. You go back to the generation before that, they're bigger and more powerful still. Right? That's the way it works in the evolutionary process. It's the older stuff is more powerful. So, and that's what's fundamentally in play here. You know, in this, you know, oh my goodness, the bride's exhibition hall, and the guys are all lined up, you know, around the block, you know, taking a number. You know, it's pretty mind-boggling to us now. But it's honoring that old horde mentality. We'll see. It doesn't take long that other things come into play, coincidentally, in the evolutionary process, that begins to motivate away from this ongoing honoring of the very, very primitive. And then, of course, the pendulum swings all the way the other direction, right? And it goes from, you know, having sex with everyone to having sex with absolutely no one, right, before marriage. Obviously you're thinking, well, boy, this is going to be confusing. You know, who's the father of, you know, right? But see, that's not an issue yet, obviously. And eventually that's going to become an issue, and we'll read about how it came to be an issue.
Then of course the fun little historical things again. Oh, so that's how we got started with wedding presents.
It adds a whole new twist, you know, next time you go to a wedding and bring a present. You're thinking about, no, it isn't because of that. You'll find yourself apologizing for something that no one knows about. But, you know, but see, the guy, you know, the husband is, you know, this is just the coolest thing. She comes with this massive dowry for all these presents, all these guys. She gives to her husband. So everyone's happy. you know, look at the haul I've got, hubby.
What do you really know about the good old days?
Okay, so, and then the other little thing, I'll just reemphasize what I was saying up front about not judging out of place. No one in the universe, none of the planetary administrators here, were looking at this and thinking, wow, they are so evil. They are so sinful, right? I mean, you can't think like that. You know, remember they brought that up. The fact that ancient peoples regarded it as a disgrace or even a sin not to be married, right? And that disgrace or sin, that's tied back to, well, was it a duty or was it a religious obligation? You know, if it was a social duty, it's a disgrace. If it was a religious obligation, it was a sin. But, you know, this is what we think morality is about, is these sex taboos, you know, or sex mores, whether or not you're conforming to them or not. You know, the universe does not think about it like that at all, because, of course, the universe knows that morality doesn't have anything to do with such evolutionary processes and stuff. It's utterly irrelevant, you know, in the eyes of the universe, about whether or not, you know, brides have exhibition halls. Right? It's just an evolutionary process. But it's very difficult for us to not project our sharp moralism about such things, project that outward onto the universe and onto God himself. Because that's why I believe this. God said that's what we believe.
right? That our morality came to us from God. So, you know, you have to challenge yourself to, you know, again, you can easily, what if you were given the job? What if you get to Gerasim and you haven't fused yet? And you get the job of being a staff member of a planetary prince on one of the budding young worlds. Right? You don't go there with a self-righteous moralism, you know, and start judging all these primitive people. You're an abomination. Right? No, you have to treat this very objectively. And you know, see it as part of a process.
Well, if you're lucky, you go there in these times of free love.
Well, we all know that's the little sidelight to having a material body again as a staff of a planetary prince. You could do that sex thing again. Okay. Anyway, all right, back to the story here.
Some tribes married the young men to the widows and older women, and then when they were subsequently left widowers, would allow them to marry the young girls, thus ensuring, as they expressed it, that both parents would not be fools, as they conceived would be the case if two youths were allowed to mate. Other tribes limited mating to similar age groups. It was the limitation of marriage to certain age groups that first gave origin to the ideas of incest. In India, there are even now no age restrictions on marriage.
Okay, so number of things there. Let's start with the first part. Remember how I pointed out that ancient tribes had recognized this issue of the lack of maturity in a married couple. You know, like they're saying that some tribes, you know, thought it was just utter foolishness to let two young people get married, you know, no wisdom plus no wisdom equals calamity, right? And so, you know, you have the unwise young man marrying the wise older woman, and then when she dies, then the now wise older man can marry, you know, the unwise young gal. And that's the way they played it. You know, and for them, it would have been an utter, you know, you can tell it would have been utter sin, just utter transgression of taboo for, you know, two people the same age to get married. There wasn't a big age difference. It was horrid. And then, of course, now it's completely the opposite. You know, we have all kinds of harsh laws and societal recrimination if two people are separated very much in age, if they, you know, start having sexual relations.
Being the cradle,
you know, right, right, and you know, and we have all of these, you know, these taboos, effectively, right, you know, in our laws about big age differences. So, you know, and again, no one on high was judging these people. Well, that's just absolutely horrid to have this older guy now with all this experience, you know, marrying this young gal. Yeah. And of course, by young, we don't mean 18 there, you know, like we just talked about that. This would be a very young gal.
Was she really going to end up without a wife later? She's really young.
Now, then the other thing, you know, that, you know, can really throw you for a loop the first time you read it, that it was the limitation on marriage to certain age groups that first gave origin to ideas of incest. You know, we think of incest as just being totally about the closeness of relationship. But see, it wasn't at all started that way. You know, it's not that that's, you know, the guy's daughter. That wasn't some taboo. It's that she was a lot younger and nothing to do with the fact that it was a daughter, say. It was just the age difference that was the issue. You know, so again, just try to think about that without, you know, bringing in your current sensibilities is difficult. And then the little parenthetical, in India, there are even now no age restrictions on marriage. Well, of course, that was back at the beginning of the 20th century. You've got the age of consent is 18 in India. All these things are evolving, rapidly, or evolved rapidly during the 20th century. And then, of course, that whole bit about whether or not there's a different, maybe there's the age of consent is 12, say, in Mexico, but, you're not allowed to get married until 18, right? Those aren't necessarily the same age. And that whole bit of 18 becoming, an age restriction for marriage, that's gotten quite universal around the globe, independent of the age of consent. And then, of course, you bring in, especially religious ideas of it being a sin to have sex outside of marriage. If you've got that definitively, obviously the two ages come together, because of that. You can't have sex unless you're married, and you can't be married until you're 18. Obviously, you can't have sex until you're 18. Get all those complexities. But, that parenthetical serves as a great little example of what I'm saying about how much this has been changing recently. If you're interested in, how it is around the planet, look up age of consent. And, you can see in some places it's still tied to marriage, right? Very definitively, that's the age of consent is just subservient to the age for marriage. But then if you have no restriction on how young you can get married, because not everyone has gone to 18 now. All right, let's keep going here.
Under certain mores, widowhood was greatly to be feared. Widows being either killed or allowed to commit suicide on their husbands' graves, for they were supposed to go over into spirit land with their spouses. The surviving widow was almost invariably blamed for her husband's death. Some tribes burned them alive. If a widow continued to live, her life was one of continuous mourning and unbearable social restriction, since remarriage was generally disapproved.
So there you can begin to see, remember how when they talked about going from hunter to herder and how women's standing got greatly diminished when they went to herder? You started getting a lot of lack of respect being enculturated. And, here you can see a combination. On the one hand, you've got this very, they mentioned before, this very definitive idea of how important it is to be married in spirit land. They may have, tried to ensure that in very crude ways. But, you can at least understand why they were so serious about it. It wasn't that they just had no respect for women. But you can also see, blending in there as well, a distinct just lack of respect for women creeping in to the more system.
Like the Pharisee, right?
Yeah.
Thankfully, he wasn't born a Republican or a woman.
Yes, right. All the various ideas that those herder peoples like the Jews back in Old Testament times, or even Jesus times, had about women, how they had no place in any definitive relationship to the law, to the temple, whatnot, but So it's it's, you know, we saw it before. Marriage is, the marriage institution isn't evolving in isolation. Ideas about the relationship between men and women isn't evolving in isolation. It's in interplay with all these other things that are evolving, like, you know, how you get food to feed yourself and whatnot. Okay.
In olden days, many practices now regarded as immoral were encouraged. Primitive wives not infrequently took great pride in their husbands' affairs with other women. Chastity in girls was a great hindrance to marriage. The bearing of a child before marriage greatly increased a girl's desirability as a wife, since the man was sure of having a fertile companion.
And so there's the whole, you know, we haven't gotten to favoring chastity yet. But the other thing, you know, the whole bit of affairs and stuff. And again, you know, if nothing else, you know that that concept could be in play just as another way of kind of continuing the horde mentality forward. You know, the farther you get along, the more there may be a lot more than just sort of vestiges of the horde mores. But if nothing else, right, it could just be that, you know, of just respecting, you know, we all know that, you know, in, you know, say, gorillas, right, you've got, you know, one male and many females. Right. So it, that's always a possibility. And just, you know, see, great pride in their husbands, see, because again, it's, you know, it's the big silverback, you know, that, you know, he's the alpha male if he has many females. And so she's very proud of her powerful husband, you know, because of this. You know, and you just don't have all of these mores that we, you know, we built up, you know, not to mention the taboos, because like I say, regarded as immoral, like I was saying a minute ago, right, this is bringing in primitive sin notions, and still today, if someone says immoral, I'll bet you the first thing you think of, oh, there must have been some inappropriate sex thing happening.
Stormy Daniels.
Yeah, right, or whatever the heck it is, right? And you know, to that's one of the most difficult challenges in the entire Revelation. I mean, it's difficult in an abstract way, say to not think of what we always think of when we hear the word spirit, or what when we hear the word personality. But when you hear the word morality, it's very, very difficult to get to what the Revelation is referring to. That it doesn't have anything to do with what's been ingrained into you since the day you were born. You know, that it doesn't have anything to do with these sex taboos. That's a very difficult challenge. And it doesn't mean that we don't have to regulate the sex urge. You know, but just to be able to have it well regulated without having to falsely bring morality into play, right? The scariness of immoral in order to us to obey the, you know, the restrictions on the sex urge. See, that's the challenge. Can we be sophisticated enough that we don't have to be motivated by fear to do the things that we're supposed to do? Was there a question? Oh, yeah, here. Yeah.
So, you know, in reading this and listening to this, it just seems like there's what's missing, the marriage part I get, but there doesn't seem to be the family aspect connected to it here. And is that what you're saying when you're talking about a horde? Were they getting married and then still being in the horde?
No, there wasn't marriage and there wasn't family in the horde.
Right, so, but they're talking about marriage here.
Yeah.
So was there family then after that? You know, if they were having kids with other people, you know, I mean...
Yeah, well,
but it just wasn't really genetic family.
Yeah, well, yeah, see, you obviously the concept of the family is evolving here, as you're seeing. I mean, obviously with a horde, there's no concept of a family. I mean, it's just kids, you know, no one knows whose kids they are or anything. It's all just an amorphous collective of humans. But slowly, you know, you're evolving towards a more definitive pair mating and a more definitive group of children that are tied to that pair. And one of the important things about that evolution that the revelators tell us about, that it, to remind you of how this isn't just some arbitrary concept of a nuclear family, if you will, that the children of that child, you know, are literally mindily tied to their biologic parents until roughly age 16.
If she went out and she had a child before, she's had a child from somebody else, so I'm going to marry her because I know she can have children.
Right.
What happens to that child? I mean, sort of like, seems like there's...
Well, they'll get to that. I mean, they haven't talked about that. We'll go through all of that. I don't want to lay it all out now because we'll get to that. I mean, exactly how those children were handled, were they tied to were they just part of the tribe, in general, or were they tied to the woman's family, or, they had ways of handling
so
that.
This is the beginning of the origin of family.
Yes, yes. But obviously, if you go all the way back to the horde, literal horde, I mean, no one belongs to anyone, and it's all just, an amorphous collection of individuals. Okay, let's see. Keep going here.
Many primitive tribes sanctioned trial marriage till the woman became pregnant, when the regular marriage ceremony would be performed. Among other groups, the wedding was not celebrated until the first child was born. If a wife was barren, she had to be redeemed by her parents, and the marriage was annulled. The mores demanded that every pair have children.
All right, so there you see it very definitively in that paragraph, that the marriage, quote-unquote marriage institution, is specifically about regulating the procreation of children. That literally there is no marriage if there are no children, and some of them taking it literally, it's like, she's pregnant, but, what if she miscarries, or whatever. No, it's not going to be an official marriage until literally she's given birth to the child, right? Just depending on how... how abstract or not they could be about it. How literal the child had to be. If I can hold that it exists, and then and only then is this literally a marriage, a pair mating, producing children. Okay. I guess we can keep going there.
These primitive trial marriages were entirely free from all semblance of license. They were simply sincere tests of fecundity. The contracting individuals married permanently just as soon as fertility was established. When modern couples marry, with the thought of convenient divorce in the background of their minds, if they are not wholly pleased in their married life, they are in reality entering upon a form of trial marriage, and one that is far beneath the status of the honest adventures of their less civilized ancestors.
There's one of those little pokes. Are you primitive or pre-primitive? They do that in many places in the marriage and family papers. Not very subtly pointing out that we have all sorts of fancy notions about how this is an advanced idea, but it's not the complexity of the rationalization scheme that the universe is judging it by. It's the truth that's flowing through it. Honest adventures, right? I mean, there's sincerity in those primitive peoples, their trial marriages. is there genuine sincerity? A lot of times today, like they're pointing out, that's what they're getting at. How much of a sobering responsibility is being met here? Now, if you're wondering, you know, why they use both fecundity and fertility there, I mean, kind of an etymological sense there, basically identical, but yeah, you may have a sense that when you say fecundity, you're connoting prolific. You know, not just mere fertility, but lots and lots of children. Okay, you know, and they're, so that's what, you know, sincere tests of fecundity. I mean, they wanting lots and lots of children. You know, that's, you know, there isn't just, it's like, well, I'm just we're just gonna have one kid or we're just gonna have two. I mean, no one is in that sort of minimalist mode for whatever rationalization scheme. Right, and, you know, or whatever it is, you know, saving the planet or, you know, economic concerns or whatever. I mean, who's going to pay for all those colleges, you know, or what? I mean, you know, they want lots and lots of workers, right? And so they're just reminding you that it's a desire for fecundity, this fertility test. They're doing one test and they're wanting that to the beginning of many. Okay, let's see. The thing about these primitive trial marriages were entirely free from all semblance of license. Remember again how natural that is. You know, we read about that not too long ago, how natural that is for evolutionary people, Sangic peoples, because there isn't the imaginative mind that comes into play with the Adamic uplift. And, you know, it wasn't Blue Man that had all these thoughts going around in their head and debauching the maidens. No, it was the Adamites going up into Europe and, you know, and engaging the Blue Man where they were debauching the maidens. Right, so that, you know, it's going to be naturally free from all semblance of license, you know, in general amongst those evolutionary peoples. They're all just being, they're going to be as matter of fact about this, you know, and kind of just, a lot of it's just going to be based upon their material pragmatism. In the same way, it's very matter of fact like that with Adam and Eve and them producing children. Okay, we need, you know, this number, you know, eventually for this region, you know, it's a very pragmatic sort of calculus that they're engaged in. All right.
Section 4, marriage under the property mores. Marriage has always been closely linked with both property and religion. Property has been the stabilizer of marriage, religion, the moralizer.
Okay, well, there's the moralizer thing. You know, I was just pointing out. I mean, that's again one of your challenges. Can you get above the moral level to genuine religious consciousness, so that religion isn't just the mores system or parts of the mores system highly exalted and sanctified, you know, in some way, and that's what you call religion. But here it is, you know, this is the what we've been looking for. What's going to be kind of the big factor that sort of brings a new dynamic to the marriage institution and the evolution of the mores? It's going to be the property mores. Like I was saying before, the marriage institution doesn't evolve in isolation. It's in interplay with the other parts of society. And so this is one of the key things is the more that you began to develop the concept of private property, which is another very important part of advancing civilization or developing civilization, just like getting to farmers from hunters, that had a big role in this, in getting it out of these modes where it just seems totally appropriate to have a bride's exhibition hall. How, you know, what's going to get it out of that mode? We're trying to head towards true monogamy. Not just genuine monogamy, but true monogamy, right? Genuine monogamy put in the full cosmic context, synchronized with the universal harmony of the cosmos. So we need something to spark change. And so property mores is going to play a big role. Okay?
Primitive marriage was an investment, an economic speculation. It was more a matter of business than an affair of flirtation. The ancients married for the advantage and welfare of the group, wherefore their marriages were planned and arranged by the group, their parents and elders. And that the property mores were effective in stabilizing the marriage institution is borne out by the fact that marriage was more permanent among the early tribes than it is among many modern peoples.
Right. So again, you know, your first thought is, oh, that's abhorrent. We're talking about women being treated as property. Yeah, well, but there was stability. You know, and no one has some sort of moralizing going on about the evils of this, you know, way back then. So we have to think about it, you know, apart from our current sensibilities. And again, you see that how natural it would be that it was more a matter of business than an affair of flirtation. Just again, because when you're, especially when you're dealing with the not very imaginative evolutionary stock peoples. It'd just be the natural thing. There isn't fancies that are sparked by spiritual idealism in play. It's just grinding along with material pragmatism. Let's see. Anything else in there? I guess we got it there. Keep going.
As civilization advanced and private property gained further recognition in the mores, stealing became the great crime. Adultery was recognized as a form of stealing, an infringement of the husband's property rights. It is not, therefore, specifically mentioned in the earlier codes and mores. Woman started out as the property of her father, who transferred his title to her husband, and all legalized sex relations grew out of these pre-existent property rights. The Old Testament deals with women as a form of property. The Quran teaches their inferiority. Man had the right to lend his wife to a friend or guest, and this custom still obtains among certain peoples.
I'll start with that zinger at the end. This is a huge problem, for instance, in Africa, right, where that more is still in play. And so AIDS spreads like crazy, you know, because they're still in that old property more. Especially, it maybe it's evolved to, it's only when the tribal leaders or officials or whatnot come through. But, you know, but whenever some mucky muck comes through the village, you know, he stays at your house, right? He has free reign. They have huge problems with, you know, entire villages just being completely wiped out, all dying because of spread of AIDS, because of a more system like that. Back to the beginning of that paragraph. Remember how difficult it was for many of the peoples, you know, especially the evolutionary peoples, to wrap their minds around the concept of private property. Red man, you know, could never really countenance the idea of private property, which, like they pointed out, that's one of the things that made it difficult for him to to advance very far, you know, in the hierarchy of civilization. And how, what an impact. So you could say, oh, be interesting to study exactly what impact that had on the marriage institution amongst red men because of their inability to wrap their mind around the concept of private property. You know, or is there other means of, you know, of advancing the concept of marriage without that? Is this the only way? So you could think about issues like that. And then the whole bit of adultery, you know, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery. Okay, they're separate. But they're pointing out, you know, if you have it still very definitively in the private property mode, you know, that's redundant. Right? All right. The whole bit about transferring title. I think everyone understands that. And then notice they bring in, okay, the Old Testament deals with women as a form of property. The Quran teaches their inferiority. There again, you have that, what we were talking about before. On the one hand, you have just the mere fact of them being treated as property, but not, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're seen as innately inferior. Right? Don't blur those two together. And we, you know, there's a strong tendency for us to always blur the two together. Well, if they're property, they're thought of as inferior. No, I mean, cows were thought of as property, you know, and as you evolved forward as herders, there was a strong tendency to have more respect for your cattle than for your wife. Okay, it's a separate issue as the herders go along in the Mori system for them to start thinking of women as inferior. Property might be a very, very high position. It isn't innately a low position. So they're just reminding you of that. That if you have a people that are herders and don't have as much influence from revelation to treat women with some respect, and you're going to also get that disrespect thing coming into the Mori system. All right, let's see, I think we got everything there, didn't we? Yeah, keep going.
Modern sex jealousy is not innate. It is a product of the evolving mores. Primitive man was not jealous of his wife. He was just guarding his property. The reason for holding the wife to a stricter sex account than the husband was because her marital infidelity involved descent and inheritance. Very early in the march of civilization, the illegitimate child fell into disrepute. At first, only the woman was punished for adultery. Later on, the mores also decreed the chastisement of her partner. And for long ages, the offended husband or the protector father had the full right to kill the male trespasser. Modern peoples retain these mores, which allow so-called crimes of honor under the unwritten law.
I mean, just deal with that the last thing first there. I mean, everyone knows about how controversial it is all over the globe with people who are still in the honor-killing more mode. And how difficult it is when people who see absolutely nothing wrong and everything right about honor killing migrate to a country that left behind such mores way long ago, and that's just an utter abomination. We all know how difficult this is, and how many of those so-called modern nations are caving to this and carving out an exception for those immigrants. It's like, well, you know, you can keep your primitive mores system and you can kill your daughter. You know, so it's, you know, we have all kinds of complications with this now. Now, the zinger, though, in that paragraph, I bring up lots of times, You know, it's not all of these, oh my goodness, the Mori system is so different or what. Now, these juxtapositions of contrast of Mori systems. The thing that's so amazing is that opening statement. Modern sex jealousy is not innate. It is a product of the evolving mores. That is so difficult to wrap your mind around that some people are, you know, have a very, very intense, visceral, jealous response to certain stimuli. It seems impossible that that's not a nature issue, that that isn't innate in the way mind attunes to our genetics. But it's not. It's a nurture issue.
It's not animalistic. No. Interesting.
It is.
Even though you see, male heads of herds fighting off other males, that's not a jealous thing.
Right. There's no jealousy concept there. Right? You don't want to anthropomorphize them like that, if you will. If anything, that's just kind of a primitive property rights sort of a thing, right, amongst a lot of those animals, right?
You want to jealousy is both male and female.
Yeah, right. But see, to just recognize, even as strong as that emotion is, that we've been taught that. You know, and it's not like you had jealousy 101. You weren't taught it like that. Right? You taught your, you know, like your first adjutant and whatnot to react that way, completely unconsciously. It just started oozing into your pores the moment you were birthed into our society and started observing the way people behave. It's one of the more startling sentences in the entire book, actually, in that regard, to challenge you to try to separate when your adjutants are taught by nurture at a very, very foundational level. It's very difficult to distinguish how those adjutants are taught at that same foundational level when they're attuned to your genetics, when they engage you. It can be, that's the whole bit of an athlete getting in the zone. Right, the first adjutant is so trained that it's as if it's just part of the machine. You know, it's a part of his DNA that he swings a club like that, or the bat like that, or shoots the ball like that, or whatever. So that jealousy is in that same mode.
So does self-mastery come in on that?
And so, obviously, yeah, think about what kind of the depths of self-mastery, right, that are required. You've got to get way down there to take a hold of such basally taught things.
Yeah,
but to know that unlike some of those, unlike things like fear, which are hardwired, jealousy is not hardwired. It's much more fundamentally changeable. So even though it's going to be difficult because you got to get all the way down to the bottom there and change a very, very basal energy phenomenon in your mind, if you do begin to turn it, it won't be regenerated in its old form coming up from your chromosomes. Because the chromosomes are not the source of it. The external world is the source of it. So just knowing that, and not believing, well, there's nothing I can do about jealousy, that's just innate. No, it's not. You don't have to respond in that very spirit poison way to that stimulus.
Whereas fear is a different kind
of thing. In this paragraph, when they go on into the honor-killing part that we were just talking about before,
yeah.
Is that a continuation of that same idea that how it functions? Because honor killing, is that jealous part?
No, I mean, see, that's another thing. In general, maybe I get what you're getting at. I mean, it's the intensity of the response of the father to, say, the daughter's behavior, you know, it may seem to be very, you know, harsh and animalistic, but that's, you know, that's, there's a difference there. That is the intense religious belief behind it. There's more will in play there than there is with jealousy. Jealousy is just, sort of, I mean, it's just the fancy animal allowing its adjutant mind to be taught that way. But when you bring in, you know, religious concepts, right, then you have ignorant usages of your free will to put your mind in such an intense state. You know, a human can be fanatical. See, because that's a product of will, unfortunate use of will. An animal can't be fanatical. It can be very, very aggressive and stuff, okay? But not technically fanatical. Okay. So, you know, that very, very intense response, you know, is predicated on you know, religious dogma. And, you know, just, you know, again, remind yourself, you've got this external religious dogma, and you unwittingly, you know, even unconsciously, bring that in and lift it up and put it on the seat to the sixth level of meaning at the top of your mind, right? It's up there at the very top. It has that full top-down power position upon your whole mind, can wield it in a very intense way, very holistic way, because it's right up there at the top, that unfortunate religious dogma you stuck up there.
So there's some of these things that are going on that we're trying not to judge them. Because just because they're, we have different mores, and, but you can take all of, pretty much all of this, and you can divide it either into a religious type of moral concept, for lack of a better word, or it can be something that is, you talked about disgrace,
right? But a key thing is kind of that you're kind of bringing up there is, it's one thing for a people, evolving people, to go through a primitive moré state in a very natural fashion, and how that can be treated very objectively, or should be. It's like, well, you know, they're just in that stage. You know, like war is indispensable in that stage or whatever. But it becomes more problematic, what I was just talking about, when you start to bring in your unnatural nature, when it starts to be something that's being willed. This can easily get out of hand, even relative to a primitive people, and one can judge it poorly. Now, on the flip side of that, we can't judge us too harshly in that regard, because the thing that's supposed to overcome that unfortunate willing is the examples of the prince and his staff, and the example of Adam and Eve and their descendants. Okay, and when you don't have that, you know, here's the way to be unnatural. You can't judge people too harshly for being unnatural in an inappropriate way. See, on the other hand, it's like, well, at least they're they're beginning to exercise their personal nature. And of course, it's got the double-edged sword thing, and they're using it in the using the unfortunate blade of the sword. They're using it destructively rather than constructively. But yeah, I mean, it reminds you. See, that once humans start to get more and more unnatural, and hence possibly in very, very self-destructive modes, it's very important to have those external examples, you know, as a counter to that. You can't overcome sin with goodness, but if there's an example of righteousness, you at least can contrast the two. It's like, well, okay, I can. Here's righteousness, and this is the way it plays out, and here's sin, and this is the way it plays out. I can see in the long term, the righteousness thing works out better. So I'm going to follow what Adam and Eve are modeling for me. You know, and that's what they try to do, is just be, in many ways, sort of just a silent example of a better way to do it. That's what Gabriel did, right, in contrast to Lucifer on Gerizim, right? He didn't try to counteract that, you know, because you can't overcome sin with goodness. He knew that, and that was sin, right? Lucifer had already crossed the line from evil to sin, right? So he didn't waste his time trying to overcome sin with goodness. He just set up a parallel counterexample so that you can pick. This is righteousness, this is sin. And if you can't tell the difference, or if sin looks better to you, well, that's your problem. Those who are not sophistry proof are not real. Okay. All right. Let's see if we can get some more done here.
Since the chastity taboo had its origin as a phase of the property mores, it applied at first to married women, but not to unmarried girls. In later years, chastity was more demanded by the father than by the suitor. A virgin was a commercial asset to the father. She brought a higher price. As chastity came more into demand, it was the practice to pay the father a bride fee in recognition of the service of properly rearing a chaste bride for the husband-to-be. When once started, this idea of female chastity took such hold on the races that it became the practice literally to cage up girls, actually to imprison them for years, in order to assure their virginity. And so the more recent standards and virginity tests automatically gave origin to the professional prostitute classes. They were the rejected brides, those women who were found by the groom's mothers not to be virgins.
Okay, so that's basically how we get into the current mode. It's hard to call it the modern mode, is it?
Maybe she just didn't want that woman.
Exactly. Yeah, you see all the between the lines issues that come into play here. Yes. All right. We all know the machinations that come into play once it gets more complicated. Okay, but just dropping back to the beginning of the paragraph. Now that we're sort of directly talking about chastity, it is an important little distinction to think about. You might not have, the difference between celibacy and chastity. They aren't, innately synonyms. In a very, very precise sense, celibacy is just about not being married. Whereas obviously chastity is about, not having sex. Chastity belts didn't have to do with, preventing marriage, okay? But obviously, if you have, it's a taboo to have sex outside of marriage, that makes celibacy and chastity, come together. It's the same fact. But in terms of just the immediacy, someone who's being celibate is not marrying. It's possible that the sex issue could be separate. Okay, so just that little thing to keep in mind, you know, and as they're talking about, you know, this group had this moray and this group had that moray, you know, just it can be very, very complicated and could have gone through lots of different paths and amongst different peoples, these sorts of ideas.
The word, I just forgot it.
Celibacy and chastity.
Doesn't chastity come from chaste or something?
Yeah, right, yeah.
How does that work? What's that?
Well, again, see, you know, some of these words are sort of kind of just what they are, but, you know, to be celibate is to be alone, kind of in a literal sense, right? Unmarried. And see, that's what I was saying. I mean, that's why that one, you know, doesn't automatically imply chastity.
So chastity coming from chaste, why is that?
Well, again, see, I mean, that's just the word means that you're not having sexual relations, okay?
I'm just looking for the etymology, I think.
Yeah, I don't remember the exact etymology of chaste. I'd have to look that up, but...
it's interesting that you bring that up.
Yep.
Because today, you know, you hear a lot about the celibate priests who are not
chastised. Right, or not chaste, yes.
Yeah. Celibate.
I didn't bring that up because I figured you could put the two together yourself on that one. Yes. But, you know, so how do you see, how do you get out of that that whole, I mean, very problematic bride's exhibition hall scenario we had earlier? See, it's the property mores that bring that into play. And, you know, and so through that mechanism, you establish that tradition, and over time, people reflect on that state of affairs and begin to get higher ideas about the value of that mode. And you see, you'll continue it for higher reasons. It doesn't matter what sort of way you kind of unwittingly found yourself, you know, getting into that mode in the first place. This is often the way social evolution works. There's some very kind of primitive way that something comes into practice, and it's held that way long enough for people to start reflecting on it and recognizing, oh, you know, there's something here. It's like arranged marriage. You force the two kids together at a young age, and they really don't have any attraction for each other. But after 20, 30 years, you know, they discover they really love each other a lot. You know, they discover a depth that wasn't immediately apparent to those hormonal eyes of when they were young. Those sorts of things, that's a way that the evolutionary process works, or the maturing process works. We find ourselves just in the presence of something that isn't what we would have picked. But reflecting on it over time, we discover a depth there that wasn't apparent, right? We go beyond the surface. We actually reflect, and we discover depth. At least that possibility's in play. So you can see here how the evolutionary process is using the property mores to slowly get us towards true monogamy.
The caging sounds a little extreme.
Yeah, right. And I was just going to bring that up next. See, now notice this. See, this is an interesting point they're trying to bring out, that once we stumbled into this concept of chastity, it caught on like wildfire. See, so it's pointing out that oh, I never thought about that. But now that I think about it, I find it strangely compelling and exciting. And, right, humans just took to this. It seems like even beyond, even beyond Andite imagination, but actually capturing the imagination of even more primitive people, more evolutionary peoples. This struck a deep chord of imaginative excitement, this idea of virginity. You know, and you can see that in the fact that we all know that once this was fully in play, we started reflecting on it, it's like, oh, this is just so incredibly powerful in my mind. I mean, obviously, if I threw a virgin in a volcano, that's going to change, you know, the God's behavior. See, that's how that gets started, because it found such an incredible resonance in you, so deep, that proved to you that this is a spirit thing, a religious thing, a God thing. Nothing else except a God thing could be that deep in me.
Mary had to be a
right, and then virgin births and all that stuff. Of course, yeah, right. But see, between the lines, that's what they're pointing out there. That, you know, we could get into the details and try to figure out exactly why, but you know, setting that aside, nonetheless, it struck a very deep, powerful chord. This notion of virginity, chastity. And so that's why it took off like wildfire and became such a religiousized, you know, concept. Okay. Let's see, what else did we have in there? I think there were some other things, wasn't there? Let's see. We already talked about the imprisoning thing, yeah. It's the end there. When in a more primitive people, there weren't prostitutes. Right? And so, you know, it's just another example of how the more complicated the system gets, the more there is going to be a diversity of modes in the society, right? It just... there has to, for there to be prostitutes, there has to be something kind of in contrast to that to generate it. It exists in contrast to something else. It sort of doesn't just exist. When there's no concept of the young gal needing to be a virgin. Right, there's no rejection of them for not being a virgin, and they have to find some way to make their way in the world then, because they're never going to be married. They're going to be rejected by their family. And you can see it's kind of like with slavery. It was a big step forward when they stopped eating, those that they captured and enslaved them. It's a big step forward when you didn't just kill the girl. You just threw her out of the household. And she had to go live on the streets as a prostitute. It seems, yeah, but it's a step forward from killing her in an honor-killing mode. So, the harshness of the evolutionary process. But then, of course, once you establish, we all know once you establish that, it takes on a life of its own. And what in some very primitive sense might have had a positive aspect to it, like slavery way back in the day, right? All good things taken to extreme become bad. And obviously things like that can quickly go beyond some short-term scaffolding validity in an evolutionary process.
This really helps look at a personal view of, or an individual view of dichotomies, and mm-hmm. the test or the challenge and that it brings up, because I mean, pretty much everything we've read in these two sections seem abhorrent in a lot of ways.
Right.
And yet, you've helped us understand that all of this. These are indispensable things. Well, not these in particular, but they are indispensable. They lead to something better. And because of you teaching that and bringing that out, when you look at the book, but I don't catch it myself. I think about that a lot, but still I'll be like digging in here, reading these little details, and I'm like, oh my gosh, honor killing really is one that gets me.
Right.
It just changes or at least has the potential to change your whole view about all of the past, even the really horrible things, bad things that's happened to this planet, and up to this time that we're in now, the challenges that we're looking at right now, I mean, they could be really falling apart.
Yeah, and even if, you know, one of these things we're reading about isn't literally indispensable, you know, you can remind yourself that the supreme mind can work with any set of finite facts. Any wild notion that humans come up with, that doesn't thwart the evolutionary process. The supreme mind says, nope, I can work with that. We're going to, you know, maybe it'll just be a very short-term leveraging off of that, because it's got lots of issues and it needs to, you know, go in the rearview mirror quickly. But nonetheless, you'll play through that. So, you know, just to be more humble about the way we judge things, right? Not only might, you know, something that we judge very negatively be indispensable to the evolutionary process, like war, say, for early progressing civilization, but, you know, like I just said, at the very least, the supreme mind will do something positive with it. You know that. You can trust that implicitly. There isn't anything that can happen in any election, you know, or anything that somehow is the end of the universe. You've just thwarted any possibility of progress now. No, there is no such thing. Anything can be used by the author of progress as a means to progress. We're not the authors of progress, right? We're at best observers. And as we go forward in our ascension career, eventually we'll be a mature enough fact that you can actually contribute something to the evolutionary process, because you won't be so hopelessly ignorant. It's like, I'm going to do something. You know, you're just going to make it worse. Just don't. Seek first the kingdom of heaven and don't try to mess with the external world, okay? the humility that we need about what's happened in the past, what exists in the present, and then reading all this, remind yourself, just think about how much all of the things that we believe are absolutes right now and aren't are going to evolve as you go forward over millions and millions and millions of years, right? There isn't anything that we think has reached an apex and should never change again that won't change. We've talked about a lot of things. There isn't any bit of geography on the planet that won't change. There isn't any human mori that won't change. There isn't any idea of God that won't change. I mean, everything will change. We can't even imagine the changes that lie in the not very distant future. None of us can even remotely imagine what it's like, what the mores, what the conduct of the people is like on a world, normal world in the post-Bestowal Sun Age. It's completely beyond your wildest imaginations how they conduct themselves. So that has to mean basically everything you can think of will change for us to finally get to a world that is effectively in that post-Bestowal Sun Age, not just technically like we are right now. And it's going to be so different. We have to let go of our white knuckle grip on everything, like I talk about all the time. I mean, and that's one of the biggest problems. When you see something solidifying so that it can't change, that is a budding emergency state of affairs. Right? If we get so fixated as in the United States that there's just no way to be able to pass a constitutional amendment anymore, get it passed, That's a problem. You know, or whatever, you know, whatever specific thing you want to point to like that. You know, when a political party gets so fixed in its doctrines, right, there has to be, to parallel with the power beings, a secondary dissociator has to come into play and rip it apart, like a dark island that's being too much of a gravity hog in a certain area of the universe. They have to unravel it. Something has to blow it up, because everything has to change. Nothing has reached, you know, the grand universe settled in light and life state. And it's like, well, how could anything be so fixed? We're just little creatures in a giant, you know, universe. Yeah, but you have an absolute dimension to your personality. If you put your white knuckle grip on something, not even God can change it. Right? If it's in your inner life. So, you know, we have to allow things to evolve.
That which cannot be coordinated will be destroyed.
Yes, yeah. Right. And if it's not changeable, it can't be coordinated. Right. So some big rock will be dropped in the pond one way or another. And we have to be more humble about this. I mean, instead of being so certain about what you think a certain outcome should be or how things should go or whatever, why don't you just delight in seeing things actually potentializing, being changeable again, and being curious about, I wonder what it's going to change into, instead of, well, if it doesn't change into this, I'm going to hate it, or it's evil. You got to stop, you know, responding to things like that. Delight in what's the Supreme Mind going to do with this? Sit back humbly and observe and enjoy. Maybe you'll learn something about how the Supreme Mind works, so that maybe one day you could help.
But don't say sit on your duff.
No, it doesn't say sit on your duff. But you get my point. I mean, right? It's just
wise about how you.
I mean, it's just right. You're trying to find that in wisdom, insight, and foresight. You're trying to, you know, and you can't find those if you think you're innately divine and what the world needs is for you to project yourself out onto the world and be the pattern for it, right? So
don't you think that can boil down to more personal level, though, where, you know, we're all coming across things that need to change all the time,
mm-hmm.
and some of the things are things that we could have a hand in, and
yeah.
And if we look at it the way you said, maybe we ought to want to, you know, for the big scale.
Yeah.
Respecting that change is going to happen, what opportunities could that bring? Maybe we could do that on a smaller scale.
Exactly.
Where we might be able to do something.
Exactly. Right. You know, that gets back to what I said. I mean, open your mouth as wide as you can. Is the diameter of your mouth large, you know, greater or smaller than the diameter of the earth? Probably smaller than the diameter of the earth. So you weren't put here to change the world. But, you know, if you observe how the Supreme works in a way so that when it changes things on the planet, they can be maintained, and it didn't change it like you thought it could change. And why? Because if you changed it directly instead of circuitously, it wouldn't have been maintainable. That's why it took that circuitous route that you didn't have the insight to appreciate. You know, if you observe how things evolve and have an ongoing stability, it's like, okay, I could do that on a small scale at work. I could foster an evolutionary process that allowed things to work out. I'm not going to, you know, in an authoritarian fashion try to impose, but I'm going to guide an evolutionary process so that everyone kind of comes to be content when all is said and done, right? Because you need you know, the requisite contentment amongst the people once the changes have been made. They don't have to be completely satisfied, right? But they need to be relatively content so that they don't rebel against it. Right? And that takes a process, because a lot of people can't learn by looking. They have to learn by leaping. So you have to take them through the process where they come to recognize, oh, I can be content with this. That, right, the wisdom to guide things well like that. And yeah, so yes, you don't sit on your backside, but you work on the projects that are your size, and you know how to you learn how to work on the projects your size by spending more time observing how the author of evolution guides the big picture.
And gaining wisdom,
right? Yeah. But anyway, you get my point. All right, so. The marriage and family papers are just exquisite in this regard of what we were just talking about, in talking about topics that are very poignant to us, and hence could possibly definitively challenge us to get some recognition about the evolutionary process, to be more humble and be more trusting in the evolutionary process. Don't fall into the Lucifer trap of wanting to make things perfect tomorrow by fiat. Okay. All right. And so next time we'll get into the further evolution of the complexities of things here with the marriage institution, and you'll see that this. We're just about done with this paper, and we'll be rolling over into full-on definitive paper about the marriage institution. So we'll get a lot more technical about it and stuff here, instead of just these early primitive kind of sloshings about relative to the marriage institution. Okay, let's take a moment, everyone.